On behalf of the Law School Human Rights Program and our co-sponsors, the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School and the J.B. Moore Society of International Law, welcome to the panel on Hamdan and the Rights of Detainees, What's Next in Court and Congress. This panel is more than timely. Today it's almost prescient as the President plans to unveil his new proposal for military commissions this afternoon. As moderator, I will introduce our panelists, and I'll do my best to keep each of them to the agreed time limit. Each will give a 5 to 8 minute presentation. We'll follow that round with a brief opportunity for the panelists to add comments. And at that point, we're going to open the floor up to you for your questions and comments. Unfortunately, Professor Martin had unexpected personal matters come up, and he will not be participating in the panel. Instead, I will briefly present what he was to have covered, the international law aspects of the case and the Supreme Court's decision. To my left, and this is the order in which our panelists will speak, is my colleague Paul Stephen, who is Lewis F. Powell, Jr., Professor of Law and Hunton and Williams Research Professor here at the law school. And he's going to highlight statutory interpretations and administrative law as dimensions of the case analysis. Next, Professor Major Sean Watts of the JAG Legal Center and School will discuss the military law aspects of the decision and impacts of the decision for the JAG Legal Corps. Following Major Watts, Elisa Massimino, who is Washington Director of Human Rights First, will follow with a discussion of the frenetic legislative aftermath of the decision. And last but not least, David Graham, Executive Director of the JAG Legal Center and School, will talk about the responses of the Department of State, Pentagon, and Department of Justice, and some of the international law and law of armed conflict concerns associated with the administration's draft military commissions legislation. So let me begin. On June 29th, the Supreme Court issued a 5-3 decision reversing the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. The case was brought by Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a Yemeni national and former driver for Osama bin Laden, captured in Afghanistan in 2001. Hamdan was transferred to Guantanamo Bay in 2002. About a year later, he was deemed eligible for trial by military commission for unspecified crimes. No charges were brought against him until after he filed writs of habeas corpus and mandamus. Ultimately, he was charged with conspiracy to commit war crimes, which the Supreme Court noted in its decision is not a recognized violation of the law of war. The majority opinion, written by Justice Stevens, concluded that the Detainee Treatment Act, the December 2005 statute that, among other things, strips federal courts of jurisdiction to review the cases of Guantanamo detainees, did not preclude federal jurisdiction of pending habeas actions. The court also ruled that military commissions, as defined under the President's 2001 executive order, violate U.S. law and Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. The majority added that although Congress had denied the Bush administration the power to hold the commissions, the President was free to ask Congress for that power, and the administration has been hard at work with lawmakers to get such approval. Hamdan may be one of the most important Supreme Court decisions involving international law in recent history, particularly so at a time of such significant debate about references to the practices of other countries and the role of international law as a factor in U.S. courts' consideration. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said that foreign interpretations of international treaties should at least be considered by U.S. courts. Here, the Supreme Court unequivocally held that the law of armed conflict, specifically the Geneva Conventions, are part of U.S. law. Having been incorporated by reference into the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and that the President may constitute military commissions only in compliance with that set of laws and other relevant U.S. law. it's important, I think, to be clear about what is at the core of this case. That is the substance of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. Common Article 3 applies to, quote, conflicts not of an international character and prohibits, without exception, quote, violence to life and person, cruel treatment and torture, outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment, and notably in the context of the President's military commissions, quote, the passing of sentences without previous judgment by regularly constituted courts, offering all judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. In his opinion, Justice Stevens looked to the commentary to the Fourth Geneva Convention for a definition of regularly constituted courts. And he notes that they include, quote, ordinary military courts and, quote, definitely exclude all special tribunals. The court in Hamdan ruled that the President's military commissions are unconstitutional and violate military law because they lack the requisite procedural protections for the accused. It's also important to be clear about the rights at stake in the President's military commission's order. The court notes that among the striking features of the commission's procedures, they allow the accused and his civilian counsel to be excluded from the proceedings and precluded from ever hearing evidence presented against him. Not only is testimonial hearsay and evidence obtained through coercion fully admissible, but neither live testimony nor witnesses' written statements need be sworn. The accused has no right to confront witnesses or to challenge any evidence against him. Further, under the military commission's order and in accordance with the Detainee Treatment Act, Hamdan would have no automatic right to federal court review of the commission's final decision. The 1949 Geneva Conventions provided for the first time a list of minimum required due process guarantees for any international or domestic war crimes proceedings. This list of due process safeguards was expanded in Article 75 of Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions, which the Supreme Court in Hamdan noted constitute customary international law. These due process safeguards have been further elaborated upon in the statutes and rules of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda and the International Criminal Court. And these international tribunals have repeatedly held that these due process rights are required of all war crimes prosecutions under international law. Now, Justice Stevens notes in the majority opinion that although the U.S. has not ratified Protocol 1, it appears that the government regards the provisions of Article 75 as an articulation of safeguards to which all persons in the hands of an enemy are entitled. Among the rights set forth in Article 75 is the right to be tried in one's presence. As a detainee captured during the war with Al-Qaeda, the court clearly notes that Hamdan has rights. And they note, regardless of the nature of these rights, they are indisputably part of the law of war. Jurisdiction to try Hamdan under the UCMJ is conditioned upon compliance with the law of war, that is, with Common Article 3. Just one more point, and that is that the clear application of the Geneva Conventions has had the administration nervous as it implicates the Federal War Crimes Act of 1996, which defines a prosecutable war crime as anything that constitutes a violation of Common Article 3 and also provides for the death penalty. In July, just after the decision came out, Attorney General Gonzalez suggested that a shield was needed to protect officials and military personnel involved in handling detainee matters. The Department of Justice immediately drafted legislation that would do just this by ruling out detainee lawsuits to enforce Geneva Convention protections and by incorporating language making U.S. enforcement of the War Crimes Act subject to U.S., not international, understandings of what the convention requires. And I will now give the floor to Professor Stephen.
Thank you, Dina. I have to begin by saying something that, to my ear at least, sounds terribly pompous, but I'm obligated to say it, which is that I'm currently on a semi-sabbatical to the Legal Advisor's Office in the State Department, and which is no big deal at all, but it does mean that I have to say that the views I'm about to express, which I think will be self-evident, are not the views of the State Department or the United States government. Although the Legal Advisor's Office has worked on this legislation, I've stayed out of that in the brief time I've been there, and so I come to this conversation unencumbered by knowledge or facts, just with views. And given that limitation, I want to focus on the one thing that I feel competent to talk about, which is the Supreme Court's opinion in Hamdan, and leave it to others to talk about the ripples in the pond as a result of this very big rock that has fallen. I have several points that I want to make briefly. First, noting Holmes' famous aphorism that hard cases make bad law, I think a codicil to that point might be that bad facts can make bad law, and the government had terrible facts in Hamdan. The purpose of Guantanamo and the purpose of the commissions may have seemed clear at the time of their creation, but both seem to be decisions made out of a sense of exigency. As time goes on, the sense of exigency disappears. This is alluded to specifically in Breyer's opinion, his very brief concurring opinion to the plurality opinion, where he says, no emergency prevents consultation with Congress. The lack of any sense of emergency and the inability of the government to articulate a good reason why we were going down these particular roads led the Supreme Court, I think, to a level of skepticism that is unusual in wartime decision-making. It's the kind of skepticism we see after the war is over. I mean, if you go back, for example, to the McCarthy era, and you line up the Supreme Court's opinions while McCarthy was in power and after he fell from power, there are two different sets of jurisprudence. And, you know, Curran and Eisentrager represent perspectives that are very different from peacetime perspectives. So either the court believes that this is now peacetime, or they believe that at least as to this discrete problem, the government had lost credibility in arguing that exigency explains what it had done. And as a result, the court itself, I think, lost some of its moorings. I'll again quote from Breyer's opinion. Judicial insistence upon consultation with Congress does not weaken our nation's ability to deal with danger. A profound and correct point, one that is true, and I think as general advice to this administration would be well taken and should be taken more. The particular problem with this case was that there was something called the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005 that fairly could have been read as applying to this case. I think, to me, the most interesting part of the conflict between the majority and the dissent is this issue. Stevens, in order to deny the applicability of the Detainee Treatment Act, had to swallow some of his earlier decisions, particularly the Lansgraf case. And Scalia, I think, and this is the only issue on which Scalia writes in dissent, I think he's got much better the argument. I'm not saying that Stevens has no argument, but I think that the very strong argument that the Detainee Treatment Act, which was not a jurisdiction-stripping statute, it was a venue statute. It said that all challenges to Guantanamo have to come in to a particular venue, can be heard by the D.C. Circuit, and conceded with certiorari jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Its practical effect, of course, was to make the next Guantanamo case heard by a full court, without the Chief Justice excluded by reason of having written the lower court opinion in Guantanamo. But I think that that reason alone is not a good federal court's reason for playing rather loose with the statute in that case. So there is fundamentally a tension in the Supreme Court's decision that I want to bring out. As a formalist, As a small C conservative, when it comes to reading court decisions, I like to start with the claim that they mean what they say. This is what I tell my students. Even if you believe they don't mean what they say, act as if they do. They will want you to act as if they do, and it's a good way to start. So reading the opinions for what they say, the plurality and Kennedy go great lengths to say, all we're doing is interpreting a statute of Congress, which Congress is free to change. And Breyer says relying on Congress for a statute is important. There's a great deal of discussion on the inconsistency of the President's regulations with respect to the tribunals with the Code of Criminal Justice, the Military Code of Criminal Justice, which is an act of Congress. All these are very good principles, but the one statute that was most on point to this case, the one setting the jurisdiction, was one the court felt free to ignore. And so when the court says, this is Breyer, all we're saying that Congress has not issued the executive a blank check. Good, true, but he's ignoring the fact that they also hadn't given the Supreme Court a blank check, but the Supreme Court treated it as if they had one anyway. And I think, just as a federal court's maven, I regret what Hamden did on this front. I don't have much to say about the international law dimensions of the case because, as I just said, the court pretended to be speaking as statutory interpreters rather than as a body that applies international law directly. And this is a mode of reasoning that's familiar to the Supreme Court. The Sherman Act, for example, is all based on a delegation by Congress to the judiciary of common law powers to develop a law of restraint of trade. And one can fairly read the Uniform Code of Military Justice as containing a similar delegation with respect to the laws of war. It does strike me as odd that in developing the common law of the laws of war, I mean, Article 3 says almost nothing other than authorizing some law to be made, so the court relied on common law principles to adduce what particular rules existed. One pattern that is particularly clear in Stevens' opinion, particularly the parts where he's not able to bring Kennedy along, where he's writing as a plurality judge, is that the one set of precedents that seem to count the least are those that would have been most immediate in Congress's mind when they drafted the revision of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and when the 1949 Geneva Conventions were drafted, namely the Supreme Court's World War II decisions such as Quirin and Yamashita. As everyone probably knows, Stevens' justice was in dissent, Yamashita, and some people have read Hamden as the law clerk's revenge, vindicating his old boss's opinion. That's really nice, but I'm not sure that's very sound common law development. And I think that if you read Stevens' opinion, he's working hardest to distinguish those cases that strike me as a relatively uninformed observer as possibly the most relevant, namely the most recent decisions before the relative legislative and international law instruments were drafted. And then my final point, I guess I'll talk a little bit about repercussions, but not those affecting the detainees. There are four votes for rejecting the idea that the law of war includes a aiding and abetting or conspiracy component. Kennedy doesn't join at that point. I just know, I have no opinion on whether that's correct or not. I'm not informed on that issue. But I do know that there's been a great deal of effort made in the scholarly community and the litigation community to say that this is exactly the concept that informs civil liability under international law, that we need aiding and abetting liability in part because the only deep pocket defendants that are available in human rights civil suits have to be gotten in that way because they typically aren't directly involved. I'm talking about multinational corporations. So I just note a tension, it seems to me. I understand the distinction. One's the law of war, the other is general human rights, but I still think there's a tension between the insistence that there there is no conspiracy in the laws of war, but it's all over international human rights law when we move to civil liability. Finney.
Thanks, Dina. Well, thanks to everyone for coming this afternoon. Thanks especially to Dina for organizing this, and also the J.B. Moore Society. You're a great partner to have over at the JAG School. I also have to include a disclaimer because I'm wearing my work clothes today. I'll have to say that my views are my own. What I'll express today is not necessarily represent the views of my school or of the Department of Defense. So that's out of the way. Well, I'll agree wholeheartedly with Dina's character of the case. This is a huge case on a lot of fronts. And although, as Professor Stephen mentioned, the court cloaks its analysis in terms of mere statutory interpretation, there are a lot more things that seem to be going on in this opinion. Absolutely some separation of powers issues that it deals with. I've been asked to comment on its import to JAGS, and I'll only take a small portion of that. The court says a lot of things about a lot of law that we practice, particularly the UCMJ. I understand some of the later panelists may talk about that. I'll focus my comments on the court's treatment of Common Article 3. Dina laid some nice groundwork for us about the context of that article, what it means to the law of war, and I'll sort of pick it up from there. It's been important to the JAG Corps for a long time. In our instruction at the school, we've often expressed Common Article 3 as that law applicable to internal armed conflicts. That is, if there's a bifurcation of the conflicts that the Geneva Conventions set out to treat, the majority of them being provisions focused on international armed conflict, Common Article 3 represents a set of minimum standards applicable to so-called internal armed conflicts, and that's how we teach it next door. It's a bit misleading, though, this term internal armed conflicts, because it might lead one to believe that we were focused on geography when we're categorizing conflicts, and that's not at all been the case over in our curriculum. What we focused instead on is the character of the parties. That is, when we're looking to apply the Geneva Conventions and we have to classify a conflict in order to figure which, or in order to figure out which portions of the Geneva Conventions apply, we've always said, okay, who's fighting? Who is it that we're talking about in this conflict? That's provided us the answer for the longest time to our question, well, which portions of the convention can I cite to? In cases where we've had nation-on-nation war, that is, international armed conflict, we've always applied Common Article 2, and by operation of Common Article 2's triggering mechanism, the bulk of the Geneva Conventions, 415 of the 419 articles in those conventions. When we encounter conflicts where we can say the parties to the conflict are a non-state actor fighting a party to the Geneva Conventions, we've said this is an internal armed conflict, or the type of conflict to which Common Article 3 applies. We took this a little bit further in the late 90s. In 1997, we really went beyond the plain reading of Common Article 3 and adopted an expression of that provision's application that had been developing in international courts for some time. The International Court of Justice in 1986 in the Nicaragua decision, followed later by the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia in the Tadic decision, had taken a look at Common Article 3 and said, gosh, this is really rudimentary stuff, isn't it? These are really fundamental protections. The Nicaragua court called it the minimum yardstick of standards applicable to all conflicts, no matter how they're characterized, no matter who's fighting them. And by 1997, our department, the International Law Department, adopted that reading of Common Article 3. And we didn't do this in a vacuum. We develop our curriculum in consultation with the Department of Defense and international law sections. But we began teaching that more broad version of Common Article 3. And that takes us up to 2002. Well, in 2002, the President is called on to make a decision about the application of Common Article 3 to our armed conflict with Al-Qaeda. Now, it's no doubt in the memoranda that lead up to his decision that we're dealing with an armed conflict, but the question becomes, how does Common Article 3 apply to this new conflict? And we get what is really, at least to our eyes over at the school, an unprecedented reading of Common Article 3. That is, informed by opinions written by the Department of Justice, the President determines that Common Article 3's application is not so much determined by the parties involved, but rather determined by the geographic location of the conflict. That is, looking at the plain language of Common Article 3, Common Article 3 could only apply to a conflict that is confined, where hostilities are confined to the territory of a single party to the conventions. Looking at the conflict with Al-Qaeda, they note that this conflict is happening all over the place. It's happening in the United States. It has, perhaps, its beginning in New York and in D.C. and Pennsylvania, but it rapidly expands to places like the Balkans and ultimately to Afghanistan. On this basis, on this territorial reading of Common Article 3, the President determines in 2002 that Common Article 3 does not apply to the conflict with Al-Qaeda. This is news to us in our department, frankly, and we change our materials to reflect that. We take our marching orders, redact all our references to Tadic, our references to Nicaragua, and that expansive reading. But we also leave behind our party-focused reading of Common Article 3 and begin to teach this territorial application of that provision. Through the Hamdan case, that position is initially rejected by the district court in D.C. that heard that case. They revert to a more party-focused approach. And then we see ultimately the appellate court breathing life back into that reading. This reading makes its way to the Supreme Court, ultimately in Hamdan, and we find the court rejecting it. And from a JAG perspective, we seem to have come full circle. Hamdan has largely, although not entirely, resurrected our old view, our party-focused view of Common Article 3. So it's actually a pretty easy fit for judge advocates. I mean, we go back to what we were doing 3-4 years ago and find things little changed. In my remaining time, I'd like to just comment on sources of authority. I haven't seen too much said about this. Dina's right. There's a lot of discussion of the Supreme Court's recent use of foreign jurisdictions jurisprudence. That is, in cases involving due process decisions, the juvenile death penalty, or sodomy laws in Texas, we've seen the court look beyond our shores. That is, they've adopted foreign interpretations as at least persuasive when reading our international legal obligations, and in some cases in reading our domestic legal obligations. We don't see that so much in the Hamdan decision. There aren't really any direct citations to foreign law as such, but there is one surprising citation. If you look at Part 6D, now this is the section where the court is taking on the administration's territorial-focused reading of Common Article 3, the support the court uses for rejecting the executive branch's wartime interpretation of treaty law is the commentaries to the Geneva Conventions. Now, there's a lot of history and a lot of baggage to these commentaries. Some people, including the court in this decision, refer to this as the official history or the official commentary of the Geneva Conventions. They look kind of official, too. I mean, they use the ICRC symbol and so forth, and we use them a lot over at the school. But I worry that this is an overstatement, that this fails to appreciate exactly what this is. These commentaries were written just after the 1949 Geneva Conventions were concluded. They're written primarily by a guy named Jean Pictet. He was an ICRC delegate to the conventions. And so he gives us, this is just one volume, by the way, there are over 2,000 pages of analysis. He gives us his observations and analysis on these Geneva Conventions. He does it article by article. Every single article has at least a page or two of his observations. Now, the ICRC are careful in the introduction to this work to say, look, this is the work of the authors. This isn't even ours. This is perhaps, according to their characterization, perhaps a horn book. And so I think that the court's reliance, particularly to reject an executive interpretation of this treaty is surprising, and I don't think we're done with this. We have to know that there are other detainee cases making their way through the federal courts at this time. Assuming that the Congress does not amend the Detainee Treatment Act to pull jurisdiction for pending cases, there are a number of Geneva Conventions issues that will continue to make their way through the courts. And I'll be looking curiously to see how Pictet figures in those as well. So, thanks.
Thank you. There are at least a dozen seats up front for all you guys who are standing. That can't be that comfortable. So I will pause for a moment so people can come sit down.
We'll see how many takers there are. perfect time.
Come on, see
there
on
really
the
are
uniform guys will come up.
There are single seats in various places.
Lots of room up front.
Thanks, Elisa.
Well, I'm so honored to be able to be here with you today. And as Dina said, it couldn't be more timely. Today, the Bush administration will publicly release its version of a military commission's bill, and there'll be a lot of discussion of that. I want to set the context just a little bit, and I'm going to really ask you to keep me short so we have time for questions from all of you. But I do feel like, stepping back from all of this, that, you know, here we are next week, 5 years after 9/11, and it does feel like a turning point from my perspective, that, you know, there were a lot of actions that the executive branch and the legislature took in the weeks and months right after the attacks, while we may have disagreed with them, and we did disagree with many of them, some of them were understandable given the need to react and the lack of information that we had at the time about Al-Qaeda. So, and the military commissions have been a piece of that struggle to figure out how do we reconcile the need to combat terrorism with our democratic values. And it was just a couple of months, I think 9 weeks after 9/11, that the president issued his military order that we are now grappling with, finally, 5 years later. And I work for a human rights organization. We work on a lot of countries that that have faced terrorist threats and have declared or undeclared sort of states of emergency and suspension of civil liberties and human rights principles in the initial period. And in our experience, there comes a time when the society has a decision to make about whether that's going to be kind of the new normal, as Vice President Cheney has said, or whether it's time to swing back. And the Congress is faced now with one of those decisions, I think, and how Congress deals with the military commissions and Common Article 3 will be an indication of where we are on that spectrum. Part of the problem from our perspective from the beginning was that the military order and the military commission's structure to begin with was instituted with, so far as I can tell, very little input from uniformed military lawyers. It was interesting. Now there have been, over the last couple of months, probably half a dozen hearings, including with the TJAGs all testifying, and one of them was asked, are you being consulted? And he pointedly said, of late we're being consulted, not so much before. But even with all these hearings, I don't feel like there's really been a full exploration of the need for deviations from a UCMJ kind of baseline for these tribunals. There's been, as there was at the beginning, a lot of assertion about the need to scale back some of the defendants' rights in these trials, but there hasn't really been a full exploration of that, and it doesn't look like there's actually going to be as we run out of time in the congressional session. But we'll see. We'll see what there have been, I think, lively debates at the Pentagon and with the, and I suspect that the version of the bill that will come out today does not have the full stamp of approval of the top military lawyers. But we'll see. Some of them will be testifying, I think, tomorrow in the House Armed Services Committee, so that'll be very, very interesting.
That's correct.
So I just want to set a little bit of a framework for what I see as the issues, and I can give you a little bit about what's happening today, tomorrow, and the next couple of weeks on Capitol Hill. A lot of the focus in our discussions, public debate about military commissions has focused very much on, the detainees at Guantanamo and the trial rules for trials of those detainees. And that's certainly an important part of the equation. But I want to break it down into three separate sets of issues. And urge you to think about it this way. One is the that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, and that is what the personal and subject matter jurisdiction of these tribunals is going to be. The early drafts of the administration's proposals that I've seen have had very, very broad personal jurisdiction, not limited to people outside the United States. Initially, not even it would have pulled in U.S. citizens as well. But I think the current proposal includes people inside the United States. And enemy combatants defined quite broadly, and terrorism defined quite broadly, not necessarily limited to the conflicts that we're currently engaged in, including with Al-Qaeda. And subject matter jurisdiction, as Sean mentioned, and you've heard us discuss so far, the question of conspiracy and other law, other violations that are not traditional law of war violations. To me, this raises the question about whether or not the administration sees this as a vehicle to do more than just authorize military commissions, but to authorize other administration policies. The trial rules is the second piece of it, and we'll talk more about that. I'm going to run out of time so quickly. But the other piece of it is the potential to redefine Common Article 3. And I think this is something that we'll see a little bit of today in the administration's proposal, and I think it's critically important. The administration's argument is that the terms of Common Article 3 are just too vague, and that they need to be clarified. Now, all of the TJAGs have testified that the terms are not vague at all, and everybody knows what they mean, and they're ready to. And in fact, Deputy Secretary of Defense Gordon England issued a memo saying, ordering the Defense Department to examine all of its policies to ensure that they comply with Common Article 3. It'd be hard to imagine how you'd do that if they felt the terms were too vague. But there is the potential both to redefine or define out some of the terms that the administration has had some trouble with or thinks are inconvenient in complying with in interrogations of Al-Qaeda suspects, and also to provide some kind of post-talk immunity for authorization of violations of Common Article 3 through amendments to the War Crimes Act. So Congress has about, I think, less than 20 legislative days left in which to accomplish all of this, which does not, and it's a campaign season, it's politically charged, so there's not as, let's say, intense focus on reaching the right policy decision, so much as there is scoring political points from both sides. So it'll be a very interesting next couple of weeks. But the plan, I think, is that there'll be bills passed in both houses that will authorize military commissions of some kind, and we'll probably have something to say about Common Article 3, and I better stop.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity of being with you this afternoon. Let me provide you with a mandatory disclaimer as well. I certainly appear here in my personal capacity and don't purport to represent the views of the Department of Defense, the Department of the Army, or my organization, the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School, and I think that will probably become painfully clear as I make my remarks. When Professor Hurwitz was organizing this panel and she was sorting out who would speak to what, she asked that I speak to the DOD and the Department of Justice and Department of State response and reaction to the Hamda decision. I can do that very succinctly, and I can do it very quickly. They really didn't like it. Now, let me expand on that a little bit. As fate would have it, I was with John Bellinger, the State Department legal advisor, at a Navy War College conference the day that Hamdan came down. And he was to give a luncheon address that day. The decision came down about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and he was instantly outside in the foyer on a conference call with Secretary Rice and the Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez, trying to sort through the opinion, trying to assess what impact the opinion would have on ongoing administration policies. And so when he came in to give his address, he essentially just threw his papers to the side and said, I know what you want to talk about. Let me try to explain to you how I've assessed the Hamdan decision and what it has done to us. Now, I don't think the State Department was nearly as surprised or shocked by the Omden decision as was the Department of Defense, and very specifically the Department of Justice. As you know, the Solicitor General argued the case before the Supreme Court. Why? Because I think the State Department still believes there's a role for international law to play in the international community, and also a role for international law to play in our domestic legal system. I think the jury may be out on the Department of Defense. I think maybe the Department of Justice threw international law out the window about 3 or 4 years ago. So I think State wasn't quite that surprised. Now, why was the Department of Defense and Department of Justice as surprised as they were? I think in the last 3 or 4 years, the administration has placed a unitary executive chip on its shoulder and has made numerous challenges to Congress to knock that chip off. Any number of times over the last 3 or 4 years, they have encroached upon congressional authority and congressional prerogatives. And each time they have done that, Congress has thrown up its collective hands and said, "Oh my gosh, don't call us unpatriotic. We'll never get elected." And so I think this administration has looked around and said, "This is working exceptionally well. Congress has backed down each and every time we've challenged it. Let's use the same approach with the court." And I think essentially this is what the administration did, because I think it's interesting that the administration, when it argued the case before the Supremes, really didn't argue in the alternative. Now, any good appellate attorney, any good appellate moot court team will tell you that you have to argue in the alternative. In other words, "Your Honors, if you don't accept this argument, plaintiff or applicant would argue in the alternative." The administration chose not to do that. It was a unitary executive approach. The president has this authority. Supremes, take it or leave it. The Supremes didn't take it. What did the Supreme Court do? I think they issued an opinion that was much more stringent, much more rigid, much more harsh, if you will, than they had to. And I think the consensus is that the Supreme Court not only knocked the executive, unitary executive chip off the shoulder of the administration, they really knocked the administration on its collective keister. Now, why did they do that? I think they wanted to send a very clear message to this administration that we are, in fact, three branches of government, that we are, in fact, a government founded on checks and balances. And if one of those branches of government, i.e. Congress, does not want to step forward and assume its responsibilities and exercise its prerogatives, then the court will have absolutely no hesitation in stepping into that void. Now, I'll offer you just two examples of why I consider this opinion to be more stringent and rigid than it had to be. The first is the court's interpretation of Article 36 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, I was prepared to read it to you, but Dina is exercising a mean whip here in terms of time, so I won't do that. But 36B speaks in terms of uniformity, and this was a word that the court picked up on. The court's interpretation of uniformity called for in Article 36B in particular is a different interpretation than the military has always had of that requirement. The court said uniformity here means that the rules and procedures of each type of military tribunal, be it a military commission, a court-martial, a provost court, all of those rules for each of those tribunals has to be exactly the same. And if you deviate, you have to demonstrate why it was impractical to have those be the same. Our interpretation of that uniformity requirement has always been that if you conduct a military commission, if you conduct a court-martial, the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps all have to use the same rules and procedures, but not that each one of those individual tribunals has to exercise the same rules and procedures. Here comes my first warning. The second specific issue that I would present to you in terms of a more restrictive opinion has already been spoken to, and that's the court's decision to apply common Article 3 per se to the ongoing conflict with Al-Qaeda, because I think they could have accomplished their same goals and same objectives by simply saying that common Article 3 reflects customary law of armed conflict. It's contained in numerous other conventions. As indicated previously, it's contained in Article 75 of Protocol 1. So they could have said all of these standards, these minimal standards, apply to the ongoing conflict with Al-Qaeda without saying that common Article 3 per se applied. But they chose to say very precisely that common Article 3 applied. Now, why did they do that? Well, there's some conjecture with respect to that. All of their discussion in terms of common Article 3 related to a duly constituted court, which is Article 3.1d. But perhaps the message the Supreme Court was attempting to send to the administration was there is this thing, Article 3.1c, that speaks in terms of outrages upon personal dignity, humiliating and degrading treatment. And by the way, you're subject to punishment under the War Crimes Act of 1997 if you violate Common Article 3. Now, those are the two specific issues that I would present to you with respect to why I think the opinion is more rigid than it necessarily had to be, and the reason the court was sending a very clear message to this administration. I'll focus on some of this in the Q&A if you want to, but in taking a look at the administration's draft proposal, at least the latest draft that I've had access to, I'm not so concerned about the rules and procedures aspect of the draft bill, because I think there are enough experts out there in the field of military justice, both on and off the Hill, that we're going to come up with pretty good rules and procedures. I am concerned with language contained in that draft bill that has some very substantial international law of armed conflict impact. And I think that there's been so much attention focused on the R&P aspect of this that the law of armed conflict issues may well be ignored or dismissed. I'll just very succinctly name three of those. I think there's language in the current draft bill, particularly in the findings section, that potentially very significantly expands the scope of this conflict. When you speak in terms of engaging in ongoing conflict with international terrorist organizations, with Al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist organizations, with terrorism writ large, you have significantly expanded the scope of the conflict. You have significantly expanded what I consider to be a very limited authorization of force contained in the AMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force of 14 September 2001. And when you expand the scope of the conflict, concomitantly you expand the scope of presidential war-making authority and power. You buy right into the unitary executive argument. The second issue that I'm concerned about is the potential expansion of military commission jurisdictional authority. The current bill has language in it to the extent that the military commission can exercise jurisdiction not only over offenses committed against U.S. interest and U.S. personnel, but also against interest and personnel of our, quote, co-belligerents or our, quote, coalition partners, whoever that might be. So potentially, if we're engaged in a war against international terrorism and a military commission can exercise jurisdiction over not only offenses against our interests but those of co-belligerents and coalition partners, the potential jurisdiction of the military commission is boundless. It has no limits, and I'm not sure that Congress wants to do this. The third issue, and I'm stopping, Dina, is the administration's attempt through this bill to amend the War Crimes Act to specifically define common Article 3 offenses. Because this is nothing more than a transparent attempt to exempt out those offenses that might constitute offenses under that Article 1C, outrageous upon personal dignity, humiliating and degrading treatment. So I think it's a dangerous thing to do. There are many other reasons why I think it's wrong to try to specifically define common Article 3 offenses, but I'll wait until the Q&A to speak to those.
Well, I want to thank all of you for very interesting comments and for keeping to the time limit. We do have a chance for each of you to make another, you know, to add your comments to each other's talk, so why don't we take this opportunity?
Well, I could just add quickly that, David, you said the jury's still out on the Defense Department about how they feel about the role of international law. And I think the jury is still out, but that the early returns are starting to look good on that. I'm an optimist about it. Maybe not rightly, but today I think later today we'll see the Defense Department will release finally the revised Army Field Manual on intelligence interrogations that we've been waiting for a long time. That's the manual that the McCain Amendment, which was part of the Detainee Treatment Act, specifies will contain the sum total of all permissible interrogation techniques used by DOD personnel or in DOD facilities. And early on after the McCain Amendment, there was a discussion inside the Pentagon about creating two sets of interrogation techniques, one of which would be the one that you see in the current manual, and the other would be for so-called enemy combatants, and that would be in a classified annex that we would never see. My understanding is that approach has been abandoned.
That's correct.
And that'll be announced today, as well as the detainee directive, which is an overarching set of rules on detainee treatment. The debate on that document internally has been, will it embrace the Common Article 3 standard, or will it seek to amend that standard and exclude parts of Common Article 3 that the administration has been trying to avoid? And my understanding is that it will explicitly embrace Common Article 3. And as the standard for detainee treatment that will apply, including to CIA personnel who operate in DOD facilities, so to all DOD facilities and to all DOD personnel. I think that could have easily gone the other way on both of those questions, and that's an encouraging sign.
Thanks. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'd simply say that although I certainly agree with you, things are looking up, and I give a lot of credit to uniformed military attorneys for being active participants in this process. The field manual has been 9 months in the making, and there was I'll use a diplomatic term, there was a lot of give and take on the field manual, a lot of consultation with the Hill before it's formally being presented today. I think the interesting aspect of it is, even though the field manual will be the gold standard for DOD personnel, in accordance with the Detainee Treatment Act, in other words, it'll prescribe the specific rules and procedures and techniques that can be used by DOD personnel. And I don't think there's any question that none of those techniques, none of those procedures are going to be violative of Common Article 3. It's often overlooked that there's a dual standard in the Detainee Treatment Act, and that for other government personnel, i.e. non-DOD personnel, the standard is not the FM. And the practices contained in the FM, that standard is a much looser standard. That standard is the cruel and unusual punishment standard of the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. In other words, it's a shocks the conscience standard. There are drug-related cases where the court wasn't shocked by two broken wrists. So you have two competing standards in the Detainee Treatment Act. I'm comfortable with the fact that U.S. military personnel now have specific guidance, and we're not going to be accused of violating Common Article 3. I'm not so sure that the other standard that applies to other government agency personnel is going to afford that appropriate amount of guidance.
And that's why, just if I could, that's why having fought the McCain Amendment and the Detainee Treatment Act standard for months, the administration is now prepared to embrace it because they have an interpretation of it. In fact, they will, I think, try to incorporate it into the War Crimes Act as constituting the substance of violations of Common Article 3. Problem with that is that they have an interpretation of the McCain Amendment, which I don't think is necessary, but it's clear that's their interpretation, which is a, you know, kind of infinite sliding scale, that if a person has valuable enough information or they're bad enough, nothing you will do to them can shock the conscience.
I just have one, you know, pedantic point, and it's not about international law, but about courts, although it's indirectly about international law. That is to say, I think that In this conversation, going back to immediately after 9/11, there has been a confusion of two different propositions. One proposition is international law and statutory rules that generally apply don't apply here because this is different. This is an emergency. And the other proposition is that these rules apply, but we have to think carefully about the way institutionally they're implemented. In particular, we have to be careful about the role of federal courts in implementing these legal rules. The simple point I'd like to make is you can have law and you can have rules without having it be enforced by a federal judge. I agree with the depiction of the administration as claiming too much and Congress not showing much backbone. I'm a little nervous with the idea that that problem requires a judicial solution, particularly when there actually, in the case of Hamden, was a statute that applied, I think, that suggested that time was not yet ripe for the courts to intervene, that there would be judicial intervention, but down the road. And I don't think we can have rule of law except when it comes to the judges. That's my point.
Thank you. John, can you come?
There's an interesting follow-up as well to this discussion of cruel and human and degrading treatment, interpreted when looking at the Convention Against Torture, for instance, as complying with a U.S. reservation to that treaty that says, look, when we're interpreting these terms, we take them to mean that understanding should be consistent with our Eighth Amendment and Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment analysis of torture and ill treatment. That is, it has to be something, as Elisa said, that shocks the conscience. Just as an interesting aside, I think Common Article 3, notwithstanding the Detainee Treatment Act, remains an important standard because we don't have a reservation to those terms on that particular provision. And that Common Article 3 remains a particularly strong and effective expression of the limits on cruel and inhumane treatment absent that reservation.
Great point. Thanks.